Mysteries with our irregular regular Ethan Cloud joining us, as well as some web wisdom about the conscription crisis of 1917. Let's begin episode 261.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
It was 100 years ago that the world fought World War I, the Great War, the war to end all wars, the war no one expected, yet everyone wanted. It was a time when technology and science lost their innocence, and the time that changed humanity more than any other single event in history. To mark the centenary of the First World War, we here at Radio Freethinker have been doing an ongoing series of segments to mark landmark events as they reach their 100th anniversary. This week, World War I, the war that made Canada.
When I send you a picture of Berlin, you'll know it's over, over there, I'm coming home.
10 million soldiers to the war have gone, who may never return again. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
Last time we talked about the domino effect that precipitated World War I. Well, this week, technically yesterday, marked the day we, Canada, declared war on Germany. Kind of. I say kind of because at the time, as a semi-independent dominion, Britain was technically in charge of our foreign policy. Ergo, when England declared war, the entire Commonwealth declared war automatically. And before I get any emails, yes, the Commonwealth itself was not yet created. That had to wait until the Statute of Westminster in 1931, which was a direct outcome of World War I. And that leads us to our focus today. What did World War I do to and for Canada? To help with our inquiry, we have joining us today in Radio Freethinker's virtual studio, our regular, irregular, and sometime historian, Ethan Clow.
Well, Don, I think you actually missed a word there, and that is empire. We did not declare war because we were part of the British Empire, fighting alongside the French and Russian Empire against the German, Austrian, and Ottoman Empire. And it's interesting because, you know, this was a war of empires, and it was the war that ended empires in the world.
Yeah, no, I find it changed the entire framework of how society is. Like we had the old way of doing things, and then the World War One, and we have sort of a sense of modernity. I think it's a very, very excellent point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really, it's kind of weird to think that this is now 100 years ago because, you know, I guess we're still kind of in that sort of 20th century worldview. But indeed, I mean, it's hard to imagine that the world back then was very different. I mean, you had the unquestioned sort of masters of the seas, which were the British Navy. And then you had the most powerful army in the world, and that wasn't America. That wasn't Russia, that wasn't France, it was Germany. And, you know, that harkens back to the sort of Prussian heritage of Germany. They had the most sophisticated, the most well-trained, the most powerful man-on-the-ground army. And, you know, there was a German empire in much the same way that there was an English empire. And this was, you know, a old-fashioned juggernaut slugfest.
True. Before we get too much into the meat, I'm just kind of curious, what should we call this conflict? Obviously, it is, it wasn't like, you know, the war to end all wars that was claimed, but it was a great war. It was First World War. It was World War I. What do you think we should be calling it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point there, Don. At the time, of course, nobody called it the First World War. It was referred to by its end as the Great War. And in fact, this is a bit of a history fact. For all you students out there who are researching the First World War, you will find a lot more results in terms of book searches by searching for the Great War and not the First World War. And in fact, you'll find the least amount of sources if you search for World War One. So that's just a bit of a, you know, history factor from me to you to help you in your studies. That's because most of the literature about this conflict was first referred to as the Great War, and then after World War II as the First World War, and then much later on we started referring to it as World War One, World War Two. That's a more modern convention.
Yeah, I guess, because again, from that interwar period too, no one would have referred to it as a numerical war. Right?
Yeah, unless they're really pessimistic.
You know, this is where Nostradamus could have really proven his point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Field opportunity, psychics.
World War I was a pivotal point in Canadian history. We have all likely seen, if not remembered, history vignettes about Passchendaele, Ypres, and most famous for us Canadians, Vimy Ridge. Let's start by recapping some of the more obvious points that changed how Canadians were viewed by the world, as well as how we viewed ourselves. The first major battle that Canadians participated in was the Second Battle of Ypres, the last major town held in Belgium by the Allied forces. Canada had the unfortunate luck of being one of several divisions defending this bulge in the war front. Unfortunate because this was the location that the Germans had decided to try one of the new wonder weapons of the war, chlorine gas. The initial target of the gas attack were French troops defending the line just west of the Canadians. Not surprisingly, when the yellow greenish cloud of death rolled over the French troops, they either died on the spot or ran for their lives. This, however, meant a hole was open that the Germans could use to break the entire Western Front and the Allied efforts and perhaps lose the war. So in spite of having witnessed the horrors the French had suffered, the Canadians filled the gap. They held the position for several days under several attacks, including more gas. They were eventually relieved by British troops, but not after having gained a reputation among the other armed forces of being damn near indestructible. Of course, there was a cost. About 2,000 died and about 6,000 were injured. According to some reports, 1 in 3 were casualties. Well, they fought hard, but overall, it was acknowledged that the Canadian troops were still pretty green. Also, their fighting was hampered by the use of the Ross rifle. The Ross rifle is a great example of why buying local can be counterproductive. You see, the Canadian Army tried in 1903 to procure the Lee Enfield rifle from the British. It was the gun they used. However, the British said no. So Sir Charles Ross approached the Canadian government and said, "Give me some money and I will make you your own Made in Canada rifle." Checks were written, contracts signed, and the Ross rifle was created. However, it never worked well. The first batch were recalled because it was more dangerous to the shooter than the shootee. It was the poor performance of the Ross rifle at Second Ypres that persuaded the British to give in and allow Canada to obtain the Lee Enfield rifles Canada wanted in the first place. The big battle of Canadian identity must be Vimy Ridge. For us, this battle marked the day we came of age as both a nation and a military power. Almost every Canadian knows of Vimy Ridge and what a great and pivotal battle it was. But I say pivotal battle of Canadian identity and not pivotal battle of World War I. Because if you skim British, French, or even American history books, you would note that none give the battle anything more than a footnote. It just goes to show you that what is great or of historical importance depends very much on perspective and who is writing the history. So just for those who don't know, what was Vimy Ridge? Vimy Ridge was a German fortress that the Allies had many times tried to capture. It was the first time that the four Canadian divisions in Europe were united as a single force under the direct command of a Canadian, Sir Arthur Currie. And where the, quote, great powers of England and France had failed, the Canadians defeated the Boche and took Vimy Ridge. Yay, Canada!
Well, Pierre Burton, I mean Don, that's just a little Canadiana joke that no one will get. But yeah, certainly, World War I, or the First World War, or the Great War, as it was generally referred to in 1919. It was the moment that Canada stopped being simply another dominion in the British Empire and became a key player in world politics. And sort of the battles that you mentioned, Passchendaele, Vimy Ridge, they marked a turning point, not just for our country, but human civilization. You know, the interesting factor about all this is that prior to this war, the worst conflict known in the West had been the 30 Years' War back in 1618. I mean, even the Napoleonic Wars, you didn't see this level of destruction the Great War brought. So it's important to keep this in mind that when the war started out, no one knew it was coming. Everyone thought this was going to be a sort of rip-roaring adventure where the boys in red would give the Kaiser's boys the old 1-2 and send the scurvy Hun back to Berlin. And you get back in time for a drink at the pub. No one realized that this was going to turn into a living hell for the next 4 years. And sort of to speak to the Canadian contingent, I mean, no one expected clouds of poison gas to be drifting across the trenches. So, I mean, it speaks to the mythos and the culture that arose around the Canadian forces and that also arose here in Canada as a country that was tough, that was strong, and that was making a difference in the war. This wasn't simply Canada sending, you know, a couple hundred troops to fight in South Africa or something. This was Canadian forces entrenched fighting the most powerful army in the world and surviving. I mean, that's a huge step in Canadian identity, and it was the start of Canadian patriotism.
Yeah, no, it strikes me because, again, you know, if you're British or you're American, you have all these other sort of military conflicts to go to, yet Canada's go-to moment seems to be World War One, and the Australians as well, and I'm going to talk about Newfoundland in a bit. You know, it seems that the First World War is almost ignored by most of the other nations in spite of the fact that how much it changed the landscape of Europe. But as far as how important it was for nation building, it was sort of the secondary nations, the Canadas, that it was so much more bigger for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it speaks to perhaps a notion in our national psyche that perhaps deserves more introspection, but this idea that we need to be born on a battlefield, that America had the revolution, France had multiple revolutions, Germany had the Franco-Prussian War. I mean, even Great Britain had conflicts with Scotland and Ireland before becoming Great Britain. I mean, Canada, we just sort of said, oh, could we sort of have our own thing? And, oh, okay, yeah, thanks. Cheers for that. You know, like, we didn't have, like, a battle that defined us. And, I mean, you know, we all saw how the Conservative government, to get back on them, tried to sort of manufacture that out of the War of 1812, which was still the stupidest war in history. World War One became our moment. It became this notion that this was Canada standing up and saying, we are a nation and we are here.
I think one of the things that is the difference in tone is when you hear the British or the Germans or the French talk about it, it was how they were bled to death. It was such a depressing moment, and there's no upside to it. Whereas for Canadians, although we suffered a lot, it was like, again, we suffered, but we proved we were a nation.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, again, like, I think that sort of narrative has actually come into question a lot in the last dozen years or so, where modern historians are looking back and saying, you know, maybe this isn't exactly the story that we've been told. Maybe this isn't exactly how things came to be. And when you sort of look at some of the factors, America entering the war around the same time as conscription coming into place, looking at the amount of British-born soldiers in Canada's army that enlisted, and looking at the percentages of, you know, how many were Canadian-born, how many were British-born, and also looking at the autonomy that Canada had during the war, it's shockingly very, very, very little. So it definitely has created a bit of a historical debate as to exactly how much was this Canada's moment. I mean, no one would argue that after the war, it brought about a lot of Canadian autonomy. But the debate often is, during the war, is the sort of the story that, you know, people like Pierre Burton and others have talked about really the story that took place? Or was it more of perhaps a little bit less glorious version of sort of the kind of poorly managed British leadership that Canada kind of found its way through?
Before pushing on, I should also take a note that another dominion, that of Newfoundland, also had a baptism by fire in the Great War. Today we see them as just another part of Canada, but at the time, Newfoundland was on equal status with Canada. Its landmark battle was Beaumont Hamel. Almost 1,000 troops went into battle on July 1st, 1916. In 30 minutes, all but 90 or so were killed or wounded. The entire platoon was destroyed. To put things into context, Canada sent about 600,000 troops, or about 8% of the population. Our dead or wounded was about 60,000, or about 10% of the troops. Newfoundland only sent 12,000 troops, but that was 10% of its male population, and over 36% of men between 18 and 35. And of those, 30% of them were killed or wounded. I should point out, actually, according to the Newfoundland Heritage website, the casualty rate was actually as high as 72% with fatalities rate of 25, according to their site. But because Newfoundland joined with Canada, I couldn't actually find any numbers that corroborated this, so take them as you will. Any thoughts on Newfoundland's contributions before we move on, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned, Don. I mean, Newfoundland, of course, wasn't part of Canada at the time. And, you know, that statistic about them losing thousands of troops in, you know, little over a minute or so of actual battle time is just kind of a sobering reminder of this kind of war of attrition. It wasn't the kind of war that I think anyone was hoping for when they went into it, where it was going to be kind of more swashbuckling adventure, and instead it turned out to be more sort of machine guns and barbed wire.
And one must wonder, you know, we know about, you know, the Canadian contribution to Vimy Ridge and all that. Newfoundland had its own. But there's also a lot of other nations. For example, France had a number one. I believe it was the Senegalese that were the ones that actually faced the brunt of that very first gas attack by Germany.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that we often focus more so on the Western Front, particularly because that's where most of our troops were. There was also the Russian Front. There was also the fight in around the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, again, an interesting historic fact, again, the capture of Jerusalem by the British at the end of the war, that was the first time since the Middle Ages when a Western power controlled Jerusalem. Another sort of history fact for all you buffs out there. So, I mean, it was a really widespread conflict. I mean, we often kind of focus on sort of Belgium and the French frontier, but I mean, again, it was all over Europe.
And of course, that worked out really well for the West, having the British taking over the Middle East area.
Yeah, there's been no consequences of that happening.
World War I also affected Canada deeply and profoundly at home. One that was most visible today, and one could argue the most impactful in Canada as a whole, was conscription. Conscription if necessary, but not necessarily conscription. A line made famous by Mackenzie King, but had its origins in World War I and the need to supply more troops for the war effort. By the end of 1915, Canada had raised 150,000 troops via rallying for volunteers. By mid-1917, about 400,000 were raised. Not bad, but Borden had promised at least 500,000 troops to Lloyd George, PM of Britain. The only way to raise these numbers was conscription. Although conscription was disliked across the nation, many of whom wanted to keep their sons and men at home to tend the farm, it met its strongest opposition in Quebec, not wanting to fight, from their perspective, for a foreign occupying king of England. Remember, Quebec was a conquered province. But it was not conscription itself that was at the root of the cleavage that is felt to this day, but how conscription was passed that has left Quebec with a strong distrust of Ottawa and a visible example as to how the wishes of Quebec could be trampled by the Anglophone majority. Borden called for a unity government, which would be a coalition of parties. Because the main agenda of this unity government was to pass conscription, Wilfrid Laurier, as leader of the opposition and native son of Quebec, opposed involvement in the coalition. This set up a real problem for Borden, because not only were Francophones opposed to conscription, but many farmers did not want to see their children slash farmhands leave. In order to ensure his re-election, perhaps as we have seen recently echoed by Harper in his alterations of the Election Act, Borden put in an electoral fix. In the Wartime Elections Act, he, for the first time in Canadian history, extended the franchise to women. But not all women. No, only women who were wives, widows, mothers, or sisters of enlisted men can vote, and those women who themselves were enlisted. He also disenfranchised, quote, Canadians of enemy origin. If you became a citizen after 1902, you couldn't vote if you happened to come from Germany, Austria, or something like that. This disproportionately ate into the Liberal support in the same way today you kind of get the immigrants tend to vote for the more Liberal Democratic Party in the States and not so much for the Conservative GOP. Just to ensure he could win, Borden also passed the Military Voters Act. This allowed anyone enlisted, regardless of their status or time in Canada, to vote. In this act, unlike ballots for regular Canadians, where you would have your local candidates on the ballot, the ones given to soldiers were simply vote for the government or the opposition. If the soldier remembered, he could put his riding on the ballot, but if they didn't, the governing party was empowered to assign the ballot as they saw fit. So if the government was like 100 votes short in Brandon Souris, they could just assign 200 soldier ballots, considering the vast majority of soldiers supported conscription. There was no way for Borden to lose. So after calling for an election on October 6th on the platform of conscription, full women's suffrage, and just for good measure, the end of political patronage, Borden's Union Party, specially created for the election, won a majority. If you look at the election map, you see a stark contrast between English Canada, which voted overwhelmingly, if dubious, thanks to the Election Act, for Borden, while Quebec was solid Liberal. It showed to Quebec that it was a minority that could have, at any time, its rights railroaded and be dictated to by English Canada, a lesson that has driven Quebec politics ever since. It also made the Conservatives a dirty word in Quebec, making it an electoral desert for the party for decades to come. So after getting his majority, Borden quickly passed the conscription law. However, to get farmers to vote, he had promised to make a number of exceptions for the draft. How many? Well, of the 400,000 called up, over 380,000 claimed an exemption. Borden was forced to eliminate this exemption, thus, by passing conscription, Quebec would be a no-man's land of Conservatives for decades, but by rescinding these exceptions, he caused the rise of the Progressive Party and others in the West, which would cause the Conservative Party to drop to third-party status for the next two elections. Side note, the Progressive Party merged with the Conservative Party, giving rise to the Progressive Conservative Party in 1942. Then, 60 years later, Harper removed the Progressive part to reform our current Conservative Party, or what I like to call Harperites. There is an irony to all this political manipulation Borden used to get conscription. The first conscripts were not called up until January of 1918, and by war's end, only 120,000 were drafted, and only 25 or so of those actually made it to France before the armistice. Your thoughts, Ethan?
Well, conscription is a controversial topic. I mean, one of the things that I learned about while studying sort of Borden and the First World War, conscription is sort of a situation of geopolitical politics that Canada found itself in. When the war started, Canada was playing a major role, and Borden had promised, you know, upteen amounts of Canadian soldiers. But then as America made moves to enter the conflict, Canada had a particular problem, and that was it was going to be quickly overshadowed by American contribution. And so Borden faced the possibility of saying, okay, well, we better up the ante here in Canada, and proposed conscription, started thinking about conscription in a very serious way. And, you know, the other interesting factor is, you know, when we look at the makeup of Canada's first wave of soldiers, over half of them were British born. I mean, many of these soldiers saw this as an opportunity to go home. So again, I think Borden and other Canadian officials thought, you know, we need to demonstrate that there's not simply just a sense of British patriotism in Canada, there is Canadian patriotism, and that patriotism reflects our desire to remain in the empire and to remain a world player. So as aside from the question of keeping up Canada's war contribution, there were these other sort of political factors that Borden was trying to navigate.
I think one of the things that struck me, I don't know, it was just, I was stunned in some ways, was the level of political manipulation that was done, legal manipulation, to sort of cook the elections, to put in a fix for the elections. You know, with the way they had the Wartime Selection Act and the Military Service Act, that I mean, I complain muchly about Harper's current manipulation of our Fair Elections Act, but this is obviously not something new. This is something that has been going on before. So, Ethan, well, what are your thoughts about the level of political manipulation that Borden had done? I mean, it almost seems criminal by today's standards in order to fix the election.
Yeah, you know, Don, it's interesting that you bring up those points. I remember one of my early sort of history classes, we were talking about sort of how governments changed during the First War and the Second World War. Interestingly enough, pretty much every democracy involved in the war became a dictatorship, essentially. And sort of the rules that you're talking about, the laws and the way they sort of fixed the election, that was commonplace both in Britain, France, I mean, Germany, everywhere. Elections became, for the most part, a show trick. You know, it was merely to placate people, but the leadership saw themselves as either necessary for the survival, or it was just a way for them to sort of justify some new escalation in the conflict. What's interesting is that Borden, as well as the opposition, saw themselves on the same side with this and sort of, you know, went hand in hand down this path.
Well, yeah, to be fair, the other side were, how do I put this? I mean, there was a great schism in the Liberal Party, because you literally had the Francophone Liberals who were staunchly against this, but you had what became known as the Liberal Unionists, who were the English Liberals, who were for this and went hand in hand in Borden's attempt to jerry-rig the elections. Canada has a dark World War I legacy as well, something to be repeated with much more vigor in World War II. And this was the treatment of, quote, enemy aliens or people in Canada who happened to be of Germanic descent. Almost 9,000 people were rounded up and put behind barbed wires on the hypothetical threat of sabotage, as well as over 80,000 others were forced to register with the government and follow strict rules for the duration of the war. I just said these were of Germanic descent. Well, that's not completely true. The vast majority, up to two-thirds, were actually of Ukrainian origin. This is because Austro-Hungary had a large Ukrainian minority. These are people, of course, who didn't like the old country, so they emigrated to Canada, where they were probably accused of being saboteurs and wrapped up. Makes you wonder why they wanted to come to Canada in the first place. And to add insult to injury, Ukrainians were also rounded up and interned in Austria as well. You just couldn't win. Now, for those who like to do the math, the number of actual, quote, enemy aliens in Canada, well, there were estimated to be about 200,000, and these included things like German, Austro-Hungarians, Ottomans, and yet largely only the Ukrainian community were persecuted. This was an odd example of racism. I remember growing up on the prairies where you had large communities of Ukrainians and Germans, yet all the jokes, the how many Ukrainians does it take type, well, they were all Ukrainians. The Poles got a few of them too as well, but none really about Germans. It's funny how racism has changed, too, between the two world wars, because by World War II, racism was no longer mainly based on ethnicity, but the color of your skin. Ethan, or should I say Herr Ernst Klondorf, where were you during the war?
Well, I wasn't born yet, so I was nowhere.
You were there in spirit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So what are your thoughts about the whole internment aspect?
Well, again, something that doesn't get a lot of airtime and, you know, the Pierre Burton books that are out there, it's an interesting aspect to this. I mean, because it did indeed mark a shift in terms of how we saw race, how we saw ethnicity at the time. Again, like, it definitely took on a different feel than what we would consider today, in that there wasn't a, quote, white race. There was an English race. There was a French race. There was a German race. And these were all distinct groups. And, I mean, back then, there was less, you know, Global Village. They were indeed very distinct in terms of culture and identity. And it was commonplace to be, well, you know, I'm British born, very clearly different from that German born person who lives down the street from me. They probably are an enemy agent. And it was just a different way of looking at the world. I mean, you can imagine if that's how we viewed a similarly colored person simply because they speak German instead of English. I mean, it does give you pause to think, well, what did we think of someone who had different colored skin, let alone someone who came from a completely, totally different culture, whether it was Japan or China or Africa?
I still find that it was bizarre that the ethnicity that suffered the most were actually the Ukrainians. And you don't think Ukrainian in World War One. They were like maybe part of the Russian Empire at the time, but they were getting it from both sides. They were interned here. Vast majority of people interned in Canada were of Ukrainian origin. And actually Austria, as I said, you know, they also interned the Ukrainians as well. It's just a bizarre thing.
Well, I mean, Eastern Europe, unfortunately, oftentimes falling under either one or two empires, Germany and Austria or the Russian Empire, typically they found themselves distrusted by both and or at the same time and hated by both at the same time, never really having an identity or a nation of their own until much more recently.
There were some other important legacies from World War One. It saw for the first time the introduction of the, quote, temporary income tax. It's hard to think today, but governments back in the age of protectionism largely financed itself on tariff and other import taxes. But as a result of the increased demands of both the war and the social responsibility it incurred, think veteran fares, a social responsibility, a covenant, if you will, the current government is reneging on. Anyway, to pay for everything, a greater source of funding was needed. Thus, the temporary income tax became as permanent as death. If the most impactful legacy of the Great War is the rift between French and English Canada, the element of greatest impact at the time was on the effect on, no, the creation of Canadian nationalism. At the outbreak of war, most Canadians, often of British descent, saw themselves first as member of the British Empire. However, after 4 years, billions spent, thousands killed, and no community in this vast nation untouched by war, from the crucible of war arose the Canadian identity. This sense of independence and identity can be seen in the insistence of Borden that Canada be given a seat at the treaty negotiations. When the U.S. objected, it was pointed out that as a proportion of population, Canada had sacrificed far more than the Yanks, and by that standard, far more deserving of a seat than they did. We also insisted on signing the Treaty of Versailles as an independent nation and not as a vassal of the United Kingdom. We also demanded from Great Britain, as recognition of our wartime sacrifices, that Canada and the other dominions be granted greater autonomy over foreign affairs, something that was codified in the Statute of Westminster after Canada unilaterally exercised this right by debating whether it would support Britain's military actions in Turkey during the 1922 Chanak crisis. Don't really worry about the details of the crisis. Enough to know that when Britain threatened Turkey with a declaration of war by Britain and the Dominions, Canada said, wait a minute, do not count us in on this until our parliament has a chance to debate it and decide for itself whether it will participate or not. By the time the parliament had debated the issue, the crisis had passed. But the precedent and the point was made. Canada was a mature nation, a right it had earned in the fires of World War One. Thoughts, Ethan?
Yeah, you know, and I think this in a certain way relates back to Borden, the Prime Minister. You know, when the war started, he was as gung-ho and as empire as you could get. I mean, he was practically the poster boy of sort of ready, eye ready. And yet by the end of the war, this is a man who's talking about sovereignty. This is a guy who has had it up to here with the British sort of paternalistic attitude towards Canada. And I mean, again, this is also, keep in mind that, you know, Canada fully went into this war thinking that they were going to get their piece of the pie at the end. They were going to have a seat at the table signing the Treaty of Versailles. And Britain said quite clearly, it will be the great powers of the world, not Canada, who decides the outcome of this war. And, you know, I think that was a moment for Canadian nationalism when it became less about empire and more about Canada as a nation. And again, when Canada started to debate in its own parliament whether we are involved in Britain's conflicts, that was a major turning point in history.
Yeah, and it strikes me, like I say, how the importance of World War One has changed. Like, again, at the time, it was this sort of sense of political independence, this sort of sense of burgeoning Canadian identity that seems to have been really the biggest outcome of the war. But today, again, it's that cleavage between English and French that has been its longest lasting legacy. But at the time, you know, we became Canada. I don't think you could put it any other way.
No, absolutely. And it marks such a turning point in terms of our relationship to the rest of the world as well. I mean, as you say, after this point, Canada starts to take charge of its foreign policy. When World War II is beginning, when World War II is beginning, it is such a different planet. I mean, we're talking about World War I, Britain rings the bell of empire, and Canada and Australia and Newfoundland and everywhere else comes running. In World War II, it's not Britain ringing the empire bell, they're calling for help. And Canada and Australia and these other parts of empire have to go and rescue the motherland. It's not a question of answering the call anymore, it's a question of preserving the empire. And that's a really, really big shift in ultimately our political nature, our relationship with Britain. It also was the final death knell of empire in the world as we know it. This final moment of Canada and Australia and others coming to the aid of the country that essentially colonized them.
Yeah, and you know, it also it creeps into our modern life, because one of the things that we've talked about on the show before that wouldn't have been they wouldn't even put it in this context before World War One is, you know, hey, Canada defeated the United States in the War of 1812. Well, you know, before World War One, no one, I don't think anyone would have saw it in that context. It would have been the Brits defeated the Brits burned down the White House, right? It wasn't Canada, because there was no real such thing as Canada. But now we just, like I say, we have Harper with his growing military nationalism can play upon the fruits of the World War One and this Canadian nationalism to go back in time and recast historical events.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the instances of sort of this revisionist history is when we go back in time, it's very easy to cross out British and write Canadian. And, you know, ironically, it does both a disservice to ourselves now, but it also, I think, unfairly wipes out real contributions to Canada and our real history, which, let's face it, at times was not very glorious or, you know, was not not all that honorable. I mean, the way that Canada treated First Nations people, the way that Canada treated people of Chinese and Japanese descent, the way Canada, to a certain extent, exploited our own people, you know, we do them a dishonor by not telling the story correctly.
Yes. The whole point of history is to be honest to history, to learn from it. Because if you don't learn from history, you're going to...
Well, you're going to repeat it.
Exactly. You can't do anything else. Yeah, no, it's important that we know history. In fact, one of the things I find ironic is when you think of Canadian wartime prime ministers, because we, I guess, really only had one or two to be fit. Well, three or four, I guess, if you count the Korean War. Mackenzie King is the one that sort of leaps out. Everyone knows Mackenzie King was sort of the big guy war. But Borden, I don't think Borden gets nearly as much credit as he perhaps should, considering how much Canada on the international stage changed. What are your thoughts about Borden's legacy?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that you can't really have a conversation about, say, the great Canadian prime ministers and not have Borden in your top five. Because, I mean, again, you're right. He, more than really any other Canadian prime minister, took us on an international journey where we saw our autonomy grow, where we saw the modern seeds of our identity begin to grow, and the sort of call to action that has been inside Canada ever since, this debate between our two identities, our French identity and our English identity, the struggle to know our place in the world, whether we are going to ever be a great power or whether we're going to remain a middle power, and what ultimately our role in the world will be. Are we to be a militaristic society, or are we to be a force of diplomacy in the world? I think that Borden, his legacy is starting that conversation and ultimately, I think, pushing us down that path. I mean, I think it could have been very, very easy for Canada to sort of not take that journey and instead to remain as sort of a dominion, to remain as, you know, an elaborate vacation spot for British expats.
Yes, with the beaver and the, yeah. No, I think, I don't know. It's just it's a stark contrast, because when you compare Borden to Sir Wilfrid Laurier, Sir Wilfrid Laurier. So it's stark contrast when you compare him to Sir Wilfrid Laurier, who was politically perhaps less adventurous, because he was against the war, he was against conscription, and as such, you know, it's his name is on the $5 bill. He has lots of things, and people know his name. But Borden, again, I don't think nearly stands out as much in Canadian history.
Well, isn't I don't have a $100 bill in front of me, but isn't Borden on the $100 bill, if I'm not mistaken?
True. So numerically more important, but everyone sees the face of Sir Wilfrid Laurier because he's on the $5 bill.
Yeah, that's sort of the ironic nature of putting leaders on bills. It's the lower amounts that get the most playtime. But yeah, I mean, Borden, and again, even from a personality point of view, we didn't get to learn a lot about Borden as the man. I mean, he was this kind of staunch, conservative, quiet man. I mean, he certainly didn't have 20th century ladies chasing him down the street, throwing their undergarments at him. He wasn't hobnobbing with poets and writers and artists.
A reference to Trudeau, I assume you're making there.
Yeah, Trudeau. Well, I mean, we don't know for sure about other parents. But anyway, I mean, he was a much more reserved man. I mean, he wasn't like a Mackenzie King. He wasn't a Winston Churchill. He wasn't this rah-rah guy. And yet, like it or not, I mean, his leadership took us through the First World War. And I think that, you know, we can't underestimate the change that went through him, as I mentioned before, going from being a pro-empire to a pro-Canadian prime minister is a really remarkable shift.
And, you know, fate could have been so much different. I don't know if you were aware of this, but he actually is a distant relative, apparently, of Lizzie Borden. So perhaps one of the tricks he used around the table at Versailles was either do this or the axe is coming out.
Yeah.
So we were going to do a little bit, sort of on a lighter note, talk about the crucifixion of a Canadian during World War One, but we don't really have time for that. So Ethan, perhaps maybe you will join us in a future episode where we'll focus more on the role of propaganda and the growth of total war in World War One. I mean, it was one of the unique things about World War One was it was no longer an army versus an army. It was nation versus nation, and everyone was seen to be part of the war. We have the mass killing of civilian populations, the terror campaigns by both sides to drive them out of war. So perhaps you will join us for that, and we'll talk more about, like I say, propaganda in the war. Thanks for joining us, Ethan.
Well, thanks for having me back, Don.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. One of the most crucial events in the history of Canada is the conscription crisis of 1917, not only in the act itself, but how the act was passed. Let's listen to some web wisdom and better understand this pivotal event.
In the summer of 1917, federal agents are combing the countryside, searching for more men to send to the front. In hundreds of Quebec villages, people take desperate measures to escape the sweep.
We went to Mass, and the priest says, there's a man coming around to pick up married fellows with no children. So I tell my husband, your sister-in-law has a lot of children. Maybe she would lend me one. Oh, the kids started to cry. My sister-in-law, all of us cried and cried. And she explained to her kids, if we don't lend them the baby, Uncle Jules will go to war. He'll get killed. We will never see him again.
Anna LaChapelle and her husband do what it takes to keep him from the front. Canada had promised to field an army of 500,000 men, but they are being mowed down faster than they can be replaced. Prime Minister Borden had also vowed that there would be no conscription. But when he goes overseas and visits wounded Canadian soldiers in British hospitals, he breaks his promise. Keeping Canada's commitment to them and to the Allies is a matter of honor.
If the survivors of these 400,000 men return to Canada feeling that they have been betrayed, have been abandoned, what will we tell them when they demand answers?
Conscription lands like a bombshell in Quebec. French-English tensions are already running high. French Canadians are enraged that Ontario has banned French as a language of instruction in its schools. They are in no mood to be forced to fight for England.
If we are asked to go fight for England, we will respond. Give us back our schools.
The Archbishop of Montreal, Monsignor Bruchesi, sends a warning to Prime Minister Borden.
Dear Sir Robert, do you not think, in light of our population, that we have largely done our share? The people are agitated. In the province of Quebec, we can expect deplorable revolts. Will this not end in bloodshed?
Dear Archbishop Bruchesi, I had the great privilege of looking into the eyes of tens of thousands of men at the front, who look to us for the effort which will make their sacrifice serve the great purpose for which it was undertaken. No one realizes more fully than I do the gravity and importance of the step which I have taken.
Henri Bourassa is firmly opposed to conscription, despite the jeers of Ontario colonists who refer to him as Herr Bourassa.
It is your duty, as Canadians and as British subjects, to do all you may possibly do to prevent the conscription bill from being voted. Your first duty as Canadians, whether of French or English blood, whether Catholic or Protestant, is to save Canada from ruin and suicide.
Sir Wilfrid Laurier, now leader of the opposition, is also convinced that conscription will tear the country apart.
Is it not true that the main reason advocated for conscription, not so much publicly as privately, not shouted but whispered, is that Quebec must be made to do her part, and French Canadians forced to enlist compulsorily since they did not enlist voluntarily.
The debate is passionate, and not only in French Canada. In English Canada, many workers, farmers, and non-British immigrants also oppose conscription. The Reverend J.S. Woodsworth, a social reformer and pacifist from Winnipeg, is one of the few English Canadians bold enough to speak out against conscription.
I am not a pro-German. I am not a slacker or a coward. I had thought that as a Christian minister, I was a messenger of the Prince of Peace. Christianity may be an impossible idealism, but so long as I hold it, ever so unworthily, I must refuse, as far as may be, to participate in or to influence others to participate in war.
Manitoba Labour leader Fred Dixon is maligned and beaten for his stance against conscription.
If I have to shed my blood, I would prefer to do it here, where I know it would be for freedom.
Despite furious objections, in August 1917, military service becomes obligatory for single men from 20 to 45. All summer, crowds in Quebec denounce conscription. Night after night, thousands march in Montreal. Nineteen days have passed since Anna LaChapelle borrowed her sister-in-law's baby.
I told my husband, look, there's a man coming to see us. My husband says, stay calm and rock the baby. My husband opens the door. Hello, sir. Sits out a chair. But the man comes straight to me. You've got a pretty little baby. She looks just like you. He talked to us for a bit. Then he said he had to be going. The sweat was pouring down my back. I couldn't stand it.
In Ottawa, conscription destroys the Liberal Party. Laurier, who has spent his career working for French-English Harmony, sees most of his English-speaking MPs desert him, joining Borden in a coalition government. The old man is devastated.
I find myself separated from colleagues whom I cherish like brothers. I follow my conscience just as they follow theirs. But this means we are living through tremors which, unless they subside, could shatter the country into pieces.
In October 1917, Borden calls an election. Conscription is the only issue.
Our first duty is to win. The ground must be carefully and completely prepared.
The Tories launch a strong campaign against Quebec. It becomes the foul blot on Canada. French Canadians are called slackers and cowards, and Wilfrid Laurier is depicted as a traitor. To ensure victory, Borden passes a draconian law, the Wartime Elections Act. All those who had come from enemy countries within the past 15 years are stripped of their right to vote. Others, however, are given the vote for the first time. Women who have a husband, son, or brother at the front, they are sure to support conscription. To no one's surprise, the Union government wins. But Borden is not out of trouble. 90% of conscripts ask for exemption, even amongst the English Canadians who voted so massively in favor of conscription. Borden responds by canceling all exemptions in April 1918. It is in Quebec City that Archbishop Bruchesi's worst fears come true. On Holy Thursday, a young man is arrested at a bowling alley for not having his registration papers with him. A mob gathers and turns violent. Canon Scott's wife, Amy, lives in Quebec City.
They ransacked the registrar's office in the auditorium building in their hunt for papers, set it on fire, and then turned their attention to the two government newspaper offices, L'Evémont and the Chronicle, smashing everything to pieces.
The mob riots for 4 days. Soldiers from Ontario and the West are sent in. The evening of Easter Monday, 1918, ends in violence and death. Amy Scott writes to her husband.
Nothing can describe our feelings as we stand and listen to the rattle of machine guns, the shouts and cries of the angry mob, and think of the bloodshed and fighting that is going on a few hundred yards below us.
In all, 4 unarmed civilians are killed and dozens injured. Honoré Bergeron, a 49-year-old father of 6. Alexandre Bussière, a 25-year-old mechanic. Joseph-Édouard Tremblay, a 23-year-old student. And Georges Demeul, just 14 years old.
The army started shooting. The little Demeul kid was with us. We got down on all fours along the sidewalk. The Demeul kid took off across the street and got hit. Next morning, when we got to work, pieces of flesh were still all over the fence where Demeul had been hit.
A year later, Sir Wilfrid Laurier is buried in Ottawa. Canada's conscripts had helped bring the war to an end in 1918. But Laurier's dream of unifying English and French Canadians has been shattered. Not since Louis Riel was hanged has the country been so divided. Laurier leaves these despairing words to those who would choose his successor.
Do not choose a French Canadian. The situation of a French Canadian Prime Minister is impossible, and he can do nothing for his people.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
An apple pie from scratch. You must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose, a morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way.
The cosmos is full beyond measure,
elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships.
I knew I had a problem.
I tried counting calories,
eating and eating.
Nobody else could possibly understand.
We understand. We're Overeaters Anonymous, and we have helped thousands of people stop their compulsive eating and start living a healthy, rewarding life.
With OA, I am living again and loving it.
Start living the life you deserve with help from Overeaters Anonymous. Find us on the web at oa.org.